Why is it that it often takes the worst times to bring out the best in people? I'm not sure why that is, except that light tends to shine the brightest in the darkest situations. If you were to take a little candle we put in birthday cakes, and you were to take that outside on a sunny day at noon and light it, would you even know it was lit? Probably not. But you take that same candle and go out at midnight and light it, and it's amazing how much light that little candle gives. It's actually the same amount of light. It just shines brighter in the darkness. And I think that's true when it comes to people as well. Last Sunday, we began a series of messages on the life of Caleb, borrowing from the title of a book written by John Kennedy, Profiles in Courage. And in that book, President Kennedy wrote, "Great crises produce great men and great deeds of courage." Not sure I agree with that. I think that great crises reveal great men and great deeds of courage. Because if you don't have the courage when you get into the situation, you're not going to demonstrate it. And we're going to see that this morning in the life of Caleb, where he showed courage in spite of antagonism, in spite of overwhelming odds against him. Caleb stood firm, courageously standing in faith. Now, last week we saw from the beginning of Numbers 13, Moses selected 12 men, one from each tribe, to go into the land of Canaan. And in beginning in verse 17, Moses sent them to explore Canaan. He said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, many or few. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or are they fortified? How's the soil? Is it fertile or is it poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." It was a season for the first ripe grapes. So they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob toward Lebo Hamath. They went up through the Negev and came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, lived. Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. When they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes the Israelites cut off there. At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. Notice here the commission of the 12 spies. They were to go and check the land out. Now, nowhere in here does Moses say, "Come back and tell us if we can conquer this land or not." That was not their mission. Their mission was simply a fact-finding research. Go check it out. Tell us what the land is like. Tell us what the produce is like. Tell us how many people there are there and the kind of cities they live in. But nowhere in this commission do you find Moses asking the spies, "Tell us if you think we can win." Now, as we look at this passage in Numbers, it seems that this is God's idea. The Lord instructed Moses to do that. But actually, if you go into Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 19 through 25, you find that the Lord is actually responding to the people's desire. It was the people who wanted to send the spies, and God allowed them to do it. G. Campbell Morgan writes, "The hour had now arrived when the people should have gone forward. The story of the sending of the spies as told in Numbers indicates it was done in obedience to the divine command. The comparison of this, however, with Moses' account of it in Deuteronomy will show that this command of the Lord was the result of a determination on the part of the people to do so. This was in itself an act of suspicion and unbelief. The people weren't quite sure. God said, "Here you go. Here's the land. I'm going to give it to you. You go in and possess it." The people are like, "Whoa, wait a minute. Let's appoint a committee. Let's check this out first. You know, we don't want to get into something and, you know, find out we bit off more than we can chew. We better check this out." And so God, as he has done on other occasions, I think of Gideon when he was hesitant to go, and he said, "Lord, you know, I'm going to lay this fleece out, and in the morning let the grass be wet and the fleece be dry," and it was. And he says, "Well, could you do it again in reverse just to make sure that, you know, you're really speaking to me?" And God graciously granted that. And that's how we should understand this as well. The people needed some encouragement. God says, "Okay, I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to send men in, and they're going to come back and tell you and even show you what a great land this is." Now, most of these names of the places probably don't mean anything to you. But what we can see from this is they were from the very bottom southern edge of what is now Israel. The spies went north of the Sea of Galilee. The entire land of Canaan they covered. And I'm sure that the 12 spread out. Some went to the Mediterranean coastline, some went over to the Jordan River, some stayed in the middle. And for almost a month and a half, 40 days, they checked it out very thoroughly. And at the end of that 40 days, they returned. And we see here in Numbers 13, there were two reports given. The first was a fearful report that was given by the majority. Beginning in verse 26, they came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account: "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does indeed flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit." And try to imagine this. One cluster of grapes that it took two men to carry on a pole. Amazing. And understand where the people have been. They've been crossing the Sinai Peninsula. You can't grow weeds there. There's nothing. It's a desert. It's desolate. And there they come back and it's, "Oh my goodness, this land, it has trees. It has a beautiful land where you can grow crops." They brought, in addition to that great big cluster of grapes, there was pomegranates and figs and just all kinds of great things. "Yes, this is a land flowing with milk and honey." But then it all changes. "But the people there who live there are very powerful. The cities are fortified and very large. We even saw the descendants of Anak." I say it doesn't do anything for you, but in those days, the descendants of Anak were giants. Okay? And there were giants that lived in the land. Remember Goliath? 9'6". He would be the top draft pick of the NBA any year. Wasn't exaggerating. He was that big. And there were giants. Now, not all the Philistines were giants. He stood head and shoulders and then some above everybody else. But they were there. I mean, they were known to live in that area. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live along the sea and along Jordan. So here's the majority report. "Oh yeah, great land. Great prosperity. But we can't do it." Look down to verse 31. "We can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. It's the Hebrew word for giants. The descendants of Anak came from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. Do you notice a change from the first paragraph I read to the second? The second paragraph is exaggerated. The first paragraph says, well, the land is great. It's fertile, it's prosperous, it's beautiful, it's lovely. And now they're saying the land itself swallows up those who live in it. Really? Initially, they said they live in fortified cities, and we saw some of the giants. Later, they said, everybody's a giant. You'd think they were scouting out Texas, right? Where, you know, everything's bigger. But you know, fear does that. Fear exaggerates the problem. Fear makes the problem bigger than it really is. Fear takes a challenging situation and makes it impossible. To the point of the people, these 10 spies, concluding, we can't do it. It can't be done. They were seeing it in fear, and their fear overwhelmed their faith. And it wasn't even accurate. And not only did they exaggerate the problem, they completely missed the attitude of the people. The very last verse I read, we were like grasshoppers in our eyes compared to them, and they thought the same thing too. But we know that wasn't the case. When you go into Joshua, when the people finally did get into the land, the very first place they stop is Jericho. And once again, a couple of spies go in to check it out. They run into this really nice lady named Rahab. But she said to them, we've heard of you people, and we're scared to death of you. We heard how your God brought you out of Egypt and miraculously parted the Red Sea, and you guys walked through it, and then when the Egyptian army came, he closed it in on them and wiped them out. We've heard about these miracles. We've heard how God has fought for you, and we know he's going to destroy us. The Canaanites were shaking in their boots or sandals. And yet these 10 spies are like, oh, we were grasshoppers in their eyes. You know, they had an inferiority complex. And they saw the problem as bigger than it really was. Warren Wiersbe writes, they saw the giants and saw themselves as grasshoppers, but they did not see God. Their eyes were on the obstacles, not on the God who led them there. Instead of reporting on the blessings of the land, the 10 spies emphasized the difficulties, giving an evil report of God's holy land. Fear always sees the obstacles. Faith always sees the opportunities. I like the way Stuart Briscoe puts it. Caleb and Joshua had grapes and the rest had gripes. Now, the problem here is not what they saw, it's how they saw it. We're going to see that two of the spies had a different report. And it's going to sound so different that you wonder if they were even in the same mission. But it was a perspective that they took. When we see ourselves as a grasshopper, when we see ourselves as nothing, not even the obvious facts make the slightest difference. The grasshopper complex is one of the most crippling of all psychological attitudes. Perhaps the greatest single sin of Christians in any century was the mistake made by those spies facing human problems with human resources. Whether it's preparing a church budget, deciding how to share our faith, tackling our personal problems, the question is often, how much can I do? We very rarely ask, how much can God do? That's what they had done. They were focusing on what they could accomplish themselves. And as a result, perpetual failure is inevitable. Instead of comparing our problems to God, we compare them to ourselves. Little wonder we feel like grasshoppers against an army of giants. When we look at things only with human abilities, human responses, and human resources, we're always going to be left wanting. We're always going to be overwhelmed by what's around us because we're not looking with the eyes of faith. Now we see that in the faithful response of the other two spies, Caleb and Joshua. In verse 30 of Numbers 13, Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." I want you to understand the numbers here. 10 against 2. 83% of the spies said, "We cannot do it. It's too much. It's too big." And Caleb said, "We need to move forward. We can do this." Actually, what he says is, "The Lord can do this." And that's the difference when you look through the eyes of faith. Look down into Numbers 14, starting in verse 6. "Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, 'The land we passed through is and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, He will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up.'" You know, they came out and said, "The land swallows up the people." No, we're going to swallow them up because the Lord is going to give us the victory. "Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." Caleb put his finger right on the problem and said, "It's fear that is driving you people. Do not fear, have faith in the Lord." That's the difference. Now again, Caleb and Joshua were on the same mission. They saw the same things. I don't think Caleb was walking around with his eyes closed saying, "I don't see any giants, do you, Joshua?" No. He saw the giants. We're going to see later on that when they get into the land, and Caleb is 85 years old, he says, "I want that mountain where the giants are." He knew they were there. He knew they had fortified cities, but his God was bigger than his problem. And that's the difference between faith and fear. In fear, we get swallowed up by the circumstances, by the situation. We listen to the majority. And if you listen to the majority today, you're going to live in fear. It's coming through our media. It's coming through our social media. It's coming through our government. It's coming from every angle. Be afraid. Be very afraid. But when we can look with our eyes open, I'm not suggesting sticking your head in the sand, but when we look with our eyes open and we see God, there's no need to fear. That's where faith comes in. It's not that we don't see the problem, it's that we do see God. Now, some might say, "Oh, you need to be realistic." We are the most realistic of all people. They're the ones that are ignoring the facts that there is a God who is bigger than our problems. I've heard this question asked before by people who like to try to trip up Christians. Can God create a rock that's too big for him to move? The answer is no, but we can. We can create a problem that we think is too big for God to handle. It's all in our mind. It's not true. There is nothing God can't handle. But in our minds, we can make the problem so big and be so intimidated by what we're hearing around us that it's too big for God. And at that point, faith is gone. Caleb and Joshua here exemplify the very essence of faith. Hebrews 11:1 says, faith is the confidence of what we hope for, that it will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see. Two things you find in a person of faith: confidence and assurance. Now, I'm not talking about cockiness. I'm not talking about conceit. Because the confidence and the assurance is not in ourselves. I mentioned a passage last week from 2 Corinthians 3 that I think is worth repeating. Verses 4 and 5. Such confidence as this before God is ours through Christ. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. That's confidence. That's a confidence that says, whatever comes my way, God is bigger. Whatever challenges I may face, God will bring me through. It's not me, not bragging on myself. God can do it. That's the attitude Caleb had. He never says, come on, guys, let's go get them. He says, God will give us the land. We can do it because God is greater. Fear sees the obstacles. Faith sees the opportunities. Fear focuses on outward circumstances. Faith focuses on an omnipotent Creator. Fear says it can't be done. Faith says, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. When life's challenges arise, will we face them in fear or in faith? Now, our story doesn't end here. Upon hearing both sides, the people of Israel accepted the majority report. We read in Numbers 14, verses 1 through 4, their furious reaction. All that night, all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, if we had only died in Egypt or in this desert, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? Then they said to each other, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Come on, we've got the majority on our side. Majority's always right. Is it? We live in a democracy. Of course the majority's always right. No, sometimes the majority's dead wrong. In fact, if we really take what the Bible says about human nature, I wonder if the majority is ever right. Unless it's a people that are moved by the Spirit of God and are following His direction. You know, people in the flesh, are they ever going to get it right? Those who don't have vision or determination, those who refuse to dream the impossible, they're always going to be the majority. That's always going to be the consensus. That's why they always want to take a vote, so they can outshout and outnumber those who walk by faith and not by sight. Those who live by sight will always outnumber those who live by faith. Here we see 10 that saw the problem and 2 saw the solution. 10 saw the obstacles, 2 saw the answers. 10 were impressed with the size of men, 2 were impressed with the size of God. And here the persistent faith demonstrated by Caleb and Joshua is remarkable, because they're standing against antagonism that vastly outnumbers them. You know, you'd have thought that the people of Israel would have applauded Caleb and Joshua for their faith. They would have been encouraged and followed them. But we read later in chapter 14, they're ready to kill them. Let's stone them to death because we don't want to hear that. We want to go with the majority. And you'll find that when the ungodly majority get in charge, they want to silence anything that doesn't agree with them. Anything that doesn't go along with their narrative, they're going to silence them if they can. It takes great courage to stand in faith against that kind of antagonism. And that's exactly what Caleb and Joshua did. Andrew Jackson once said, "One man with courage makes a majority." I've heard some people say, "God and me makes a majority." And that's true. If you are the only person standing in faith and you're standing in God, you're on the winning side. It doesn't matter what the poll results are. It doesn't matter what the election results are. If you're on God's side, you win. And sometimes that means you're the only one. You might be the only one in your family. You might be the only one at your workplace. The only one in your community. The only one in your circle of friends. Maybe the only one in your church that sees God instead of the problem. Are you willing to take a stand? Going back to that book, Profiles in Courage, Kennedy wrote, "It takes great courage to do what you think is right, even if it may mean the end of your career and the dislike and criticism of your friends and neighbors." He's right. And Jesus told his followers, get ready, because that's what's going to happen. Now, we keep reading in Numbers 14, God's ready to wipe everybody off the face of the earth and say, I'm done. And Moses intercedes and says, well, you know, God, if you brought these people out of Egypt and did all those miracles and you slay them here, what's that look like? You know. And God relented, but he did say this, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed, but who disobeyed me and tested me, not one of them will enter the land. But Caleb's different. He has a different spirit. He follows me wholeheartedly. I will bring him into the land, and his descendants will inherit it. You want to talk about being outnumbered? Some scholars estimate there may have been 2 million people in the nation of Israel at this time. You know how many of them got into the promised land? Two. Joshua and Caleb. That's it. Everyone else died in the wilderness over the next 40 years. God says, I'm going to honor their faith. I don't care if they were outnumbered by everybody else. They're going to win. Everybody else loses. That may be what we face today. We may be the only one. You stand strong. You keep seeing God, and you will overcome. The majority said, we can't go in, and the Lord said, you won't go in. Caleb said, we can go in, and the Lord said, you will go in. He has a way of bringing those that have faith through where everybody else falls. So how do we apply this message today? The lesson is quite clear. The majority is not always right. In fact, it's very often wrong. The men God uses have always stood against the flow. Men like Martin Luther and William Carey, William Wilberforce, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We need to remember this. Ours is a day when truth is determined by consensus, when justice is struck by a 5-4 vote, when everybody doing it has become the pervasive rationale for behavior, when Thomas Jefferson's fear of the tyranny of the majority is a reality. But those who have faith don't necessarily go along with the majority opinion. You find out where God is going and you go that way. I remember growing up learning a little chorus. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. And one of the verses, though none go with me, still I will follow. That's what Joshua and Caleb could have said. That's what we need to say. Because only then will we experience the life God promised, like Caleb did. When we stay faithful to God, He will stay faithful to us. So are we going to face life in fear? Or are we going to face life in faith? That's going to determine the outcome of our lives.